Hello, Tomorrow Built Today listeners. This is one of your co-hosts, Jana Mesher-Smith. For those of you new to the podcast, we cover investing trends and predictions along with discussions about the latest news in tech. This week, we are bringing you several talks from Lightspeed's Enterprise Scale Summit that took place recently in San Francisco. You'll hear firsthand from industry icons in the enterprise with their tips for successfully scaling a company. One note to keep in mind is that because we recorded this live, which included a lot of hand gestures and animation from the speakers, the voice quality isn't perfect, but the content more than makes up for it. Please sit back, enjoy, and be ready to take notes. In this episode, you'll hear a conversation between Henry Ward, CEO and co-founder of Carta, and Will Kohler, Lightspeed partner.
Thank you, everyone. Welcome. It's my privilege to introduce Henry Ward, who's founder and CEO of Carta. Before I begin, how many of you are familiar with Carta, the company, and what they do? Awesome. How many of you are customers? And raise your hand if you're not a customer. Okay. The reason I'm asking is when my partner Adam and I begged and pleaded to Henry to accept us as one of their investors, we knew pretty much everything about the company. What we didn't know is that after investing, Henry actually would require us to help him sell. So if you just raised your hand that you're not a customer, please expect to get hit up and be a Carta customer by the end of the evening. And I will fulfill my quarterly quota. Henry's an exceptional founder. What aside from just being a product visionary who had the insight to start with kind of an act one with a cap table product, which we'll talk about, that earns the right to go and do so much more. What really impacted us as Lightspeed was the mission behind it. And he told a story that, you know, there's tens of thousands of Uber drivers and Lyft drivers that were not able to experience the benefit of equity wealth. And that, in fact, is what's creating this wealth gap in our society today. And a lot of the reasons are structural. It's literally within the capital market system. So the mission was profound, and the execution and the ability to earn the right to go solve that is something that we knew we wanted to be a part of. So please welcome Henry Ward. So the topic for us is scaling people, team, and culture. Before we do that, however, please talk about your background and then the inspiration behind Carta. Yeah, but it would be great for people to have a little bit of perspective on where you came from and your journey.
Yeah, sure. So I'm a Midwestern boy from Michigan. I actually had the opposite experience of Jay. My mom signed me up for piano lessons, but she quit on me. She said I was unteachable. So a lot of
I'm
therapy.
I'm withholding all comments.
Yeah, a lot of therapy through that one. And I went to the University of Michigan, as everybody who grows up in Michigan does. I did enterprise software for a little while, and then lived in France for a couple of years, and did a little bit of investment banking. And investment banking realized I wasn't for it, so I moved here and ended up being an accidental entrepreneur. I didn't expect to start a company. It was sort of like, you know, if you move to Hollywood for family reasons, you might audition because it'd be fun. And so I tried a company. It died. But I couldn't imagine doing something else. So I ended up doing what was at the time eShares. And what was compelling about the idea at the time was it originally started this idea of why can I buy General Electric stock at the time for $7 online, click a button, everything's super easy. And then if I'm investing in two founders in a garage, it's $20,000 in legal fees, 60 days to close. I'd literally get a paper stock certificate in the mail like you used to get when you financed the railroads. And it just seemed like a weird bifurcation of the world. And so the idea was, could we go fix that and make the private world look like the public? And I was always been a financial infrastructure geek, so it really appealed to me. And then what kind of that unlocked was, well, if you really could build financial infrastructure from two founders in a garage all the way to the largest companies in the world, there's a lot more you could do with it, right? You could connect global capital markets together. You could create more owners by issuing equity seamlessly and cheaply, just like you put people on payroll. Like, we think 50 years from now, people will look at the dark ages of today and go, could you imagine you used to go sign up for a job and all you got was cash? You could work 30 years and have nothing left over when you retired other than the the grains of wheat you saved along the way. And so it just unlocked this ability to rebuild financial markets in a way that's, today it's super grotesquely disfigured how Wall Street works. So that's what got really appealing.
But it started with a cap table. So you go around the valley, hey, I want to build a cap table company. What was the feedback you got?
You know, it's interesting because this was, the seed round was back in 2013. And this was like when Instagram just got bought and Snapchat was up going. And, you know, VCs aren't necessarily...
By the way, the investors of Snapchat are awesome.
Yeah. Well, that's funny. So I'm going around to the seed, you know, doing the seed round and I'm pitching, you know, stock certificates. And you know, and VC, rationally so, are lemmings. Because they're following what every other VC, you know, it will do. And so I'm going there and I'm pitching stock certificates and they're like, hey, I actually had one say this to me. Hey, is there like a photo sharing component to this stock thing? And so it was tough. Back then, fintech was payments in 2012. Capital market, fintech didn't exist. Now it's hot, but back then, fintech was payments. And Sand Hill Road knew nothing about fintech. And in fact, we couldn't get the Series A done here. I got thrown out of every Sand Hill VC, but then when I went to New York, I met with three firms, got three term sheets, and you could just see like they were way ahead of the game. It took a while for Sand Hill Road to catch up.
But Sand Hill and a lot of the market has adjusted to fintech. It's very hypey. But the idea of the conventional wisdom of you have to invest in a big market still holds. So I think you have a very unconventional approach to thinking of dominating small markets. And there's a distinction that you like to talk about of being an N of one versus a one of N. Maybe you could talk about that as the strategy of how you think about product introductions. Yeah.
Yeah, it was interesting. Another criticism of Carta early days in the seed round was there were stages, right? And today it's sort of like, seems kind of obvious you need stages to build a really generational company. But back then, and actually it's rational. It's stupid, but it's rational. Where a VC said to me, you know, Henry, I don't like companies that have stages. Like, we invested in MongoDB, and you build the database once, and then you can sell your way to $1 billion in revenue. But you've got to like do this cap table thing, and then you got to figure out some other stuff, and then you got to do a stock market, and like there's just like each gate that you have to get through is another opportunity to fail. And so I don't like companies with stages, and so. So we're very much the opposite. We're like, we love stages because it gives us concrete milestones to get through. And so whenever we look at new markets, we think of, so databases will never be an N of one market. An N of one market is a market where there's one and only one winner. It's a one event. There will always be multiple databases because you need different types of use cases. We like N of one markets where we can be the one and only winner. And we don't care how big it is, as long as it will support a monopolistic effect for us, we're in. That's what we do. And we just take over new N of one markets together and start stringing them together. And the beauty of it is you string enough N of one markets together, you suddenly put together a pretty big monopoly. And that's what we do.
What's the implication on that approach to building teams? Because you almost have to redefine or reassert yourself in each one of those markets and re-identify team structure, service versus product orientation. So maybe talk about how the learnings you've had with that approach.
Yeah, so I used to compete a lot with, at the time, like Zenefits and some of these other, you know, Gusto and things like that, even in like Instacart, where it's sort of like these B2B SaaS type businesses. And if I was recruiting someone against Zenefits, I would tell them, I said, hey, whether you come to Carta or Zenefits, it's really a decision about what kind of company do you want to work for? Do you want to work for a company that's an execution-focused or an innovation-focused company? Because, you know, if you're doing HRIS or ADP, it's MongoDB. You have a path to $1 billion in revenue. For us, it's cap tables. There is no path. Like, we have to keep finding the new markets. So we're always going to run out of oxygen in any room that we're in. And so instead of building, when you're at Zenefits, you just have to scale. You just build the machine. And for us, the machine is not actually the execution. The machine is finding the new markets. And so we're an innovation one. We're charting the trail through the fog. and we're mapping it as we go. And it's just the question, do you want to, and it's not a judgment call, it's do you want to be on it like, here's our path, everyone get in line and go? Or is it like, hey, let's kind of wander through the forest and figure it out? And so you first have to attract the people that enjoy wandering through the forest. And then the second is you have to build the teams where they can constantly attack new efficient frontiers. And so like for Jay, we actually launched our second product 3 months after our first product. And it was just because we just knew any market we were in, we were going to run out of oxygen, and we had to find new air.
What if you're wrong? Like, what if you've got this band of believers, and hey, follow me, wander through the market. I mean, wander through the forest, but whoops, I chose a market incorrectly. Like, what implications has that had on team development? Their motivation to follow you?
Yeah, you know, there's something about human nature that it's. I don't know. Actually, I don't think it's human nature. I think it's school. Most of the world's problems I blame on school.
We're clear, we just found out earlier that Austin, your five-year-old, is having trouble in school as well.
Because, yeah, he hates school too. Yeah. So
this is now being
Apple
passed down to the next generation.
Yeah, Apple doesn't.
Yeah.
And he's like complaining about his teacher, and I can't really argue back. I'm like, I get it.
The future's bright for the worst. Yeah.
He's going to struggle like I did. Hopefully she doesn't quit on him, too. Yeah, there's something about we're taught to, like, assume that 90% of, especially if you're a good student, like, 90% of the things you do are correct. And, in fact, like, in my world, 90% of the things I do, I get wrong. It's just really important that when I do get it right, I get it really right. And so it's tough. You do have to train the team, like, we're going to swing at a lot of balls, and we're going to miss a bunch of them. But when we do get it right, it's magical, and that's what we're looking for. But it's tough, and we have a lot of bad ideas. A lot of things don't work out. And that's where I think you really have to have the missionaries. And I know it's overdone, and I hate that term, but it's really true. Like, people that really care about where you're going, they're a lot more resilient than people that, like, are like, hey, I did a good job, what's my next good job? And I think the best companies, you have this combination of missionaries and people that just execute and kind of grind it out. I think the best innovative companies have to have a large cohort of these missionaries that will run through a brick wall just to see what happens.
It's well said, by the way. You're a CEO on a journey that every next path or every next level of scale is you seeing it and experiencing it for the first time. What have been the biggest challenges in scaling yourself and the learnings you've had, the tough moments, the sleepless nights?
It's pretty amazing. People think I work hard. I don't. People think it's stressful. It's really not that stressful. It's just one of these things where, like, we're really good at getting lucky, including in finding the people that just come to us. And you can see, like, when somebody comes, we get a new executive that's just like you're on this train, and then the train lurches forward. And I think what we're good at doing is getting lucky at attracting the kind of people that like to solve the problems we need to have solved. And that's why, like I always said, I'm not sure I'd do a second company, because when I look back at every single fork in the road that I got lucky, like, I don't think I could ever get that lucky again, because it's like flipping heads 32 times in a row. And it just seems like each, I was thinking about your question about, what's the single most important thing we learned about scaling or that we did right. And I would say it's that we just knew we didn't know how to do it. And so we kept trying to find new ways to figure it out. And that brought the right kinds of people who helped us figure it out.
You've made a couple comments that I wanted to re-ask, because I think it gets into a great conversation. You've said you think it's unfair that founders are exempt from the blame of scaling challenges, yet executives are the ones that typically hold the blame. I'd love you to just explain that.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, because I was at one of the venture funds talent team, not yours, a different. And
if you're going to talk shit, yeah, mention the firm by name, that's fine.
So I was asking the exec recruiter there, who's helping us, do the exec recruiting, and I said, hey, what do you consider success when you place an exec? And they're like, if the exec lasts 18 months, we consider that we nailed it. And I was like, Jesus, I'm glad I'm not an executive. That sounds terrible. And it's really interesting because whenever, and this happens like at the board level and everything, like whenever like, you know, your CFO or your VP of sales or whoever is not doing great, the first conversation they have is, do we have to replace the CFO or the VP of sales? But if I'm like struggling, I hope you guys don't get around saying like, hey, what are we gonna do with Henry? We gotta get rid of him. What everybody does instead is go like, we need to get him a better CFO, or we need to get him a VP of sales, or we need to get him a chief of staff, or whatever it is. And I was like, why do I get exempt? And like my executives come to me like when I'm messing up, and they're like, Henry, dude, like you really need to get your shit together. They're like, let's go find somebody to help Henry. And I asked this question like to everybody, like why is the world that way? I had a young executive that goes, it's religious, Henry. And I'm like, I'm not a prophet. There's something more practical there. There's some like a religion around founders. And I realized there's two things. If you're a PE CEO, you're out, right? But if you're a vision CEO, it's different. It's hard to find that. You can't just like go to the market.
You can't replace vision.
Right. It's hard to find. It's like it doesn't. You know, you don't find that on LinkedIn. And so one, it's harder to replace. The other is that there is a unique role that the founder CEO has, is that he or she are the only people that can hire people better than them, and it's cool. Right, like if you're a CFO, you don't hire a VP of finance that's better than you, because then you just, we'll make that person the CFO. But every person that works for me is better at what they do than I am. And that's yeah. Okay. There's only one thing I have to do better than them, and that's recruit people better than me. And as long as I can keep doing that and I can tell the story, I have job security. Until if I can't tell the story or I can't find people who know how to solve these problems, I don't. And, you know, in any one of these roles, I mean, unless you're at Apple, Facebook, you know, type level, Salesforce type level, like, there are people in the world that have scaled this stage of organization. Like, you can find them. They get more expensive, but you can find them. And so that's why everybody feels like you just got to go back to market and find the person.
Maybe setting some context, how many people is Carta today and how many offices?
We're 8 offices. We're approaching, I think we're... almost 1,900-ish something.
Yeah. And it's tough to pinpoint, but if you were to say how much of your time is spent recruiting, hiring, working with teams, what percentage is that today? How has that evolved over the journey so far?
So I would say probably 25% is internal stuff, 25% recruiting, 25% external, and then 25% kind of like everything else. One of the things that, so I do a lot of recruiting executives, and then I also am available to anybody that needs like key hires for closing. So I do a ton of that. And I think the thing I can do most, I can be most helpful to the organization, is helping the executives and the middle management recruit. Like that's maybe the highest value thing that I can do. We hire about 50 people a month today. And it's going to about 70 to 80 next year. And so just helping them get these people in the door is a big part of my job.
Yeah. What's I mean, there's this balance we talked about, like not many companies proudly say we're scaling 35 to 50% every year. That's not your ambition so far. Where does it start to break as it results in people, hiring, culture, maintaining that kind of growth rate? And is it an artificial growth rate? Is it something you feel the pressure to achieve, or just the natural order of what the market's giving you?
Yeah, you know, it's really, so we're doing 2020 planning right now, and it's really interesting.
I'm about to hear the number for the first time.
Yeah, no, you will. I'll tell you what we're
35%.
Like, please. No, I know. So it's actually really interesting. These are the real numbers. So, you know, we started this year at $49 million. We'll end around $95 million in ARR. And so the question next year is like, we're doing like, okay, 95 to what is the question? And they, you know, the math people are doing the math, and they're like, you know, we could, you know, maybe do 175 million is like the thing. But all these things would have to go right to do this, right? And if this didn't go wrong, so like that's the Rubik's Cube of all the possible outcomes. And it was really interesting. And so why do you pick 175, and what's a good growth rate and all this kind of stuff? And we never really care about that stuff. We kind of pave our own way. We could care less about market comps. But it was actually interesting because we just went through this exercise. I said, look, what if, so 2020 planning is always a revenue maximization problem. You have all these constraints, and then you're like, how do I maximize revenue? And I said, what if we said instead, like, look, we're just going to have a base level of growth. Like, call it whatever. Let's say we're just going to go to 160, and that's it. And it's not a maximization problem. It's a constraint. It's a minimum problem. Just get to 160. What would you maximize otherwise? Like, what else would you do? Like, would you then maximize on logos? Would you then try to maximize on NPS? Would you maximize, right? What other metric would we care about if we were to reduce the goal on revenue? It was actually really interesting. They came back and they said, actually, we have no other ideas. Like, there's nothing we would do.
It's all revenue.
Yeah, it's all revenue. Just like, literally, it's like, there's nothing interesting enough to like, if we dropped $15 million in ARR, that doesn't give us anything else. And what you realize is that the reason you want growth, investors want growth for a different reason, but the reason you want growth as a company is because that's what drives everything else. And so you actually, there is no cost of growth, right? We actually did the exercise. There is no cost of growth. You want to grow because that's what pulls everything along with you.
On the journey, maybe some, I mean, I think the founders would love, founders or CEOs in the room or any entrepreneur would love to hear your perspective. How have you been able to determine with this idea of an executive half-life, like, is an executive scaling? Are they not? When does it become apparent to you? Is it the typical, I wish I had made decisions earlier when I first know, or like, what have you learned?
There's this great piece. I can't remember. I apologize. I blanked on who wrote it. But there's this great piece about how companies scale non-linearly and executives scale linearly. And that's why there's this rotating door of executives. And, I think people can scale non-linearly. I actually don't agree with that. I think you see lots of examples of people that have just done this, and I think it's phenomenal. But I do think where it breaks is it's always this experience versus trajectory thing, where you go out, you know, let's say this example, you know, let's say we want to hire a VP of sales to take us from 100 to 200 million in revenue. Well, you know, they might have done this. So they know how to do this. So you bring them in, they do the 100 to 200, and then they scale out. And what happens is you get these executives that, and I think this is true of any stage, where they come in, they do well because they fit in the expertise that they were hired to do, and then suddenly it comes out of their expertise, and that's when they falter. And it is the rare person that comes in, uses that expertise to get you where you wanted to be, but also grew during the same period of time, so they are ready for the next stage. And it's that combination of expertise plus growth. And I think sometimes you get the young, you know, low expertise growth people that everybody wants to bet on, but sometimes it's a little too much too quick for them. And then the other side, you get that, I'm an expert, here's my playbook, and I don't learn anymore, like I'm past that in my career, I sell my skill. And then you have to rotate them out. And boy, when you find that person that's both, it's magic. And they're the people you want to keep around for a decade.
What does culture mean to you?
That
was a curveball, by the way.
Yeah. You know, so we're going through a whole culture exercise too. And when we think about culture at Carta, I hate the culture stuff, like integrity, you know, do good things, be nice. Like
go to school.
Yeah, go to school, show up on time. And, you know, so what we think about is in virtues, because I think culture is really about, culture is things like, hey, do people stay, you know, it's Ben Horowitz's thing, at Four Seasons or the Red Roof Inn, right? When a customer is mad and wants a refund, do you give it to them or not, right? That's culture. It's how people make decisions. But when you pull it back, so we think about culture in three ways. I said one way. So we think about culture by asking the question of how do we want to be remembered? And so the first thing is, how do we want to remember each other? And so we think about things like, we want to remember each other as helpful, transparent, fair, and kind. We also think about, how do we want others to remember us? And we think about things like, we want people to think of us as relentless, unconventional thinkers, masters of our craft. And then we also think about, pulling out one more lens, how do we want history to remember us? What is our legacy in the world? And we want them to think about a company that bent the arc of human history by tackling wealth inequality in a way that nobody else had. And we wanted them to remember us for our people, because the diaspora of Cartons will go on and do even better things than we did together. So when we kind of pull those things together, that's how we think about culture and sort of zooming out and then drilling that into things like, that means we always do the right thing, right? And that's part of our decision-making framework. So it's really interesting stuff. We're thinking through all this stuff right now, but it's fascinating.
So if you go on Glassdoor for any founder here of a scaling company, not all the reviews are awesome. How does that make you feel as you're growing a company and certain things start to pop up? I mean, how quickly can you actually start to really impact change within a company, learn from mistakes, realize are these just disgruntled people or not? Is it really a reflection of culture and not just Glassdoor or all the other kind of feedback loops that now exist?
You know, so we had a lot of good Glassdoor, and then we'd have bad ones, and it's internet, so it's like 5 or 1. But you know, we had a string of ones, and they weren't just ones. They were really, we clearly hurt the employee. They were hurt, and you know, whatever it was, they were lashing out was because we had wronged them in some way, and you know, we really looked at that as what did we do? Why the question wasn't why they were unhappy. I mean, it happens. Like, you know, there's bad fits, things like that, and people don't like to be let go and can react that way. But there was something else there, and we really spent a lot of time soul searching on why it's understandable if someone's unhappy that we let them go, but why did we hurt them when we let them go? And so we spent a lot of time thinking about our process for doing that and things like that. And you know, one of the things that we did is we no longer make people sign separation agreements. I think it's inhumane, you know, to walk a young person into a room with their HR rep and a lawyer, tell them we've taken away their livelihood, they're out on the street, and hey, sign this thing to say that you're not gonna say anything bad about us or do anything bad. It's fucking wrong. And so we also institute another thing, which is I think it's crazy that if you terminate someone, we call it a departure. If you initiate a departure to someone, you pay them 3 months or whatever it is you pay them, but if they leave on their own, you don't pay them anything. That doesn't make any, like, why would you pay somebody who didn't do a good job to leave the company, but somebody that's been with you for 5 years, you know, decides to move on, and you're like, well, see ya. Like, that's crazy. And so now we have equal departure. So you leave no matter what, for any reason, we pay you the same, whether we initiated it or you initiated it. We're also building out like a career center. So it's this weird thing, like, you know, you worked at Acarta for 5 years, you've been a big part of the journey, you leave, and we're like, well, good luck to you, right? Like, we should be helping them find the next stage of their career, the next path. Like, you know, colleges do it, why wouldn't we do it for our alumni? And we have a huge network, right? People who are at Acarta all know each other, and they've all gone on to do great things, and they'll pull each other there, and so there's just a lot of things, like when we pull back the hood of how companies do these things, it's really stupid. I mean, you look at a lot of stuff that companies do, and it's really stupid. It's because that's what everybody else did, but nobody kind of thought about it.
Yep.
Again.
The Gap Table Initiative. One of our partners, Janet Masterschmidt, who's part of Hashtag Angels, you know, they were very interested in trying to understand the gender equity gap on cap tables, and you raised your hand. You know, Carta has data that could actually be used for something beyond just revenue. Like, maybe talk a bit about what inspired you, why you reached out to offer some assistance, what that initiative means to you.
Yeah, sure. So Jana and Jessica and Chloe and April, kind of the angels, hashtag angels, Twitter angels, wrote this post a couple years ago about the gap table, and this whole thesis was, you know, you could look at salary inequality, but it's really a rounding error on the wealth that's created in Silicon Valley, that if you really want to look at sort of the virtuous cycle of wealth is created, you have to look at the cap tables, because the future, you know, millionaires would then become the VCs that would then invest and so on. And if there was a gap, so the chaos theory, right? If there was a small gap in the cap table early on, that would have huge impact moving forward. And so the point was that if you didn't solve that gap, it would be a male-dominated venture community forever. And it made sense. So I read this thing and I responded. I said, hey, well, let me know if I can help on this one. And so they came in and we did the study last year, and then they did a follow-on study this year. And, you know, the data's pretty egregious. Their thesis was right. But I think, you know, why we care about it is we just generally care about inequality. We have I was telling you about my son. Like, I give my son timeouts, and he gives me timeouts. We're a pretty egalitarian family.
We agreed I can now give you timeouts, which I'm going to try.
Well, that's the problem he's having in school, is he tried to give his teacher a timeout.
Did he really?
I couldn't blame him. I would have tried too.
But dad does it at home.
Yeah. So you know, and if you believe this world of, you know, that we started in a, you know, human history, really, with labor compensation, started with feudalism and serfdom, where you're indentured to the land. You were legally free, but economically indentured. And now we're in the era of payroll, where employees live on the debt stack, and then investors live on the equity stack, and that we're trying to usher in the new world of ownership, where
founders are on the equity stack too.
Founders too. We're complicit, for sure. And so, you know, it started in Silicon Valley. We're trying to make it more widespread so that everybody will get ownership in companies and productive assets. But a big thing about not just solving the inequality gap between taking wage earners off the debt stack of a company and putting them on the equity stack is also, when you do put them on the equity stack, how do you make sure it's fairly distributed then? And the only sample set that we have today is Silicon Valley, where they ubiquitously give out ownership, and it's disparate. Yeah. It's not even. And so we have two vectors, right? One is, how do we expand ownership and democratize it broadly? And then vertically, is in the sectors that we start doing that, how do we make sure it's done well? And that's where we're very excited about how they think about the world.
It's awesome that you're involved in that. And I know #Angels really appreciates your support. Last question, you kind of hit on it, but I think I have to specifically ask, what is the single most important thing? No, you gotta wait for the answer, I mean the question. If you can pick just one, to enable scale.
I think it's finding a team around you that covers your weaknesses. When I recruit execs, I'm very clear. I say, look, I'm good at seeing a market and opening and finding a beachhead. And how do you enter this market? There's something here that's not quite right. I think we can get in there and start something. I can plant a seed. I'm good at that. And I'm good at imagining, if you were to win, what would this market look like at maturity? But I'm really terrible at how do you get there. Like, the in-between is not me at all. And so I hire people that know how to get from A to Z. Like, I can say which hill we should go after, but I don't know how to read a map, a compass, like how to get people to go there, all that stuff. So if you actually come to our office and you meet the people around the room, they're all execution. Like, they run Tokyo, you know, subway stations. So when I think about scale, it's really about, how do I build a scale around me so that my weaknesses don't take the company down? Because the company will only grow as far as I grow. So how do I make sure I get people around me that can help me grow?
Awesome. It's an honor to be on the journey with you, man. And thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Henry Ward, everyone.
Thank you.
If you want to find out more about Henry, you can follow him on Twitter at Henry S. Ward. Thanks again for listening to this week's episode. If you enjoyed it, please go to iTunes or wherever you're listening to and rate and review it. You can also find us at tbtpodcast.com. Tomorrow Built Today is produced by Lightspeed Venture Partners. The theme music you heard today is by Mikhail Manbalin.